funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between science and politics in America, and how much influence should their leaders have on one another's ambitions and decisions? Although some argue that scientists should try to entirely disregard social, political, and ethical values as they're working, my guest today argues that's not only impossible but unwise, given the major role science plays in policymaking in the modern world. Heather Douglas is Wolf Chair of Science and Society at the University of Waterloo and author of the 2009 book Science, Policy, and the Value-Free Ideal. Her lecture tonight to the UT Dallas Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology is titled Science versus Politics, the Battle for Integrity. The event starts at 7:30 and it is free and open to the public. Heather, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about this value-free ideal in science. What is it exactly, and why do you believe it's a bad idea given the current realities of science and government in the U.S.?
So the value-free ideal developed out of the sort of crisis of science and politics in the 1950s and trying to figure out how to move forward in an age after World War II where it was clear that science was going to be really central to the future of America. And Vannevar Bush's book, The Science, The Endless Frontier, showed and described a world in which, you know, science would be a driving force for the prosperity of America. But as things progressed, it was really sort of unclear what the relationship between science and politics and science and society should be. Philosophers thinking about this argued about the role of values in scientific reasoning in particular. And what they argued was this, that science should in many ways be kept as separate as possible from society, that that's how science was supposed to gain its integrity, was a separateness in both, to some extent, in setting the agenda for scientific research, that they thought that scientists should have a sort of autonomy in setting the agenda, but also in the deciding of how to think about the evidence that science produced. And so out of that came this sort of ideal that values, particularly social and ethical values, really shouldn't play a role in scientific reasoning in particular, especially when looking at specific pieces of evidence or trying to figure out what should count as good, reliable evidence for a particular claim.
Of course, the problem with that is that, you know, at the end of the day, scientists close the door to the lab or come home from the field and they're living in the real world. They're influenced by the things that everybody else is influenced by. I mean, why do we even imagine this is possible?
Well, so, of course, it is an ideal. So the thought was that, yes, scientists are human, and yes, they will be influenced by their culture. But what we want is the ideal was to for scientists to strive to eliminate those influences as much as possible. And you can sort of see this in the sort of the artifact of putting on a white lab coat as mm-hmm. a sort of symbol of purity and distance and authority with respect to science. And what I argue in my book is not that that's a completely misguided general idea. But the instantiation in the specific practice doesn't take into account the fact that science has such an important role as an authority in our society regarding empirical matters, that when you really want to understand the way the natural world functions, the best place to go is science, even if particular pieces of science might be erroneous, or even if you find that you think that scientists aren't asking the right questions, it'd be kind of crazy to just try something else mm-hmm. instead of going to science. And that means that scientists have to think about what that authority means for their practice. And this is something that they hadn't really done and that philosophers weren't taking into account when this value for ideal was really coming into a clear formulation in the 1950s. The authority of science was not thought to be sort of part of the things that need to be thought about.
So in other words, there was no consideration given to the fact that when particular results are released to the public, it will have an impact on the way people perceive things.
Exactly. And the idea was sort of, well, of course, the scientists would just get it right and then they would just pass it on to the public and then the public could act on it.
Wouldn't that be great?
Wouldn't it be great if scientists always got it right? But of course, scientists don't always get it right. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the actual practice of science, it's quite difficult sometimes to know how to interpret the evidence and whether the evidence is sufficient for the kind of claim you think it might be supporting. And so that that's where I think that social and ethical values inevitably and necessarily, it's not just that they creep in because scientists are humans. It, because scientists are in a society, they need to think about those social and ethical values in deciding whether or not the evidence is actually sufficient in a particular case.
Well, okay, so we have scientists that we trust to tell us about the natural world. Of course, sometimes two very reliable, very scientists full of integrity come up with different conclusions, and then we're left with the question of which one to trust, both or neither, or one or the other?
Yeah, so sometimes scientists come up with different conclusions for entirely legitimate reasons. They're looking at different evidence. They have sort of different interpretive backgrounds, perhaps from slightly different disciplines, or one sees a potential flaw in a methodology that another one doesn't. And when that's the case, one of the things that you might ask as a citizen is, okay, well, given that there's genuine uncertainty in the scientific community, where are the consequences of getting it wrong worse? Mm-hmm. So if we believe scientist A and we follow – make our decisions based on what scientist A is saying, and it turns out the scientist A was wrong, would that be worse than if we listened to scientist B and scientist B turned out to be wrong? But there are also cases where scientists disagree for illegitimate reasons. And this is where there's a particular worry about the politicization of science in American culture and the creating of sort of fake expertise to create the appearance of debate and doubt when there might not be any. And so there are also things that citizens need to know to think about. How can I detect when an expert might not be a genuine expert, when there might be a real problem with the claims that they're making? And it's not just a matter of legitimate scientific dispute.
So this is a difficult issue for a lot of people who are outside the scientific community who want to understand the scientists but say, look, you guys are all the experts and I don't know how to choose who to believe. What can the scientific community do to guide our ability to find the right experts?
So one of the problems I think is I would actually change the direction of that partly because scientists can't control the message from other scientists, right? The scientific community is essentially an open communication body.
Sure.
And I don't want to have like a gatekeeper organization between science and the general public. I think that would be really hard to set up institutionally and probably way too much of a temptation for corruption to have that kind of a gatekeeping body. So the question then is less certainly there are things scientists do, but there are things I think a citizen can do in trying to assess what counts as a good expert. And there are things, especially with the internet these days, it becomes much easier to do these sorts of things. So you can look and see, does the expert have a PhD in the field which they're speaking about? And a lot of experts these days, especially in the 80s and 90s, we had this sort of era when anyone with a physics degree could say anything about any other field. And that's and while physics is a very important and valuable and wonderful science, expertise in physics doesn't give one generally expertise in other scientific areas. So make sure that the expert has not just a PhD, but also that they've published in the journals that are important in their field. So that takes a little more research. You have to not just find out where they got their PhD, but they actually check the journal and go to the journal's website. Do they have an editorial board of people that look, you know, like they're reasonable experts? Do they have a peer review process? So do a little bit of research that way. And, you know, if your expert fails one of those two tests, then you know there's a problem. Mm-hmm. Like, why is this person not publishing in the journals that are sort of standard of record for this field? Is it because they are saying something that all the other scientists think is clearly wrong, and they just are getting their papers rejected in the peer review process?
Well, but sometimes the journals get it wrong too. And I'm thinking of the famous case of the Lancet and the autism study that came out.
Yes. I mean, so these are just rough and ready checks, because in the case before, if someone has their paper rejected by peer review journals, it could be that, you know, the scientists are getting it wrong. Mm-hmm. Maybe they do see something. But in the Lancet case with autism, I mean, that was really quite tragic, because it now looks like the scientists actually fabricated evidence. And what's really unfortunate is journals can't tell when data has been fabricated in the vast majority of cases, unless it's done so sloppily. Mm-hmm. So I've seen cases where someone just in sort of making images of their Western blot, for example, just copy the same one over and over. So it's really obvious, like, wait, like, you know, any peer review should have been like, there's something funny about these diagrams. They don't quite look like they should. But in most cases, if a scientist is fabricating data, like the case of Mark Hauser or the Lancet case with the autism, it's impossible for the journal to tell. And then the public has a difficult job of potentially having to wait to see how the story plays out in as the scientific research gets out there. Because the other thing that the scientific community does is use each other's research to do further research. And if you have something that's false that you've assumed from someone else's research, whether it was because they fabricated or falsified evidence or because they just got a conclusion incorrect due to an interpretive error, that should end up affecting everyone's study who follows.
Mm-hmm.
And so it should become apparent that there's a problem.
But the house of cards falls eventually.
The house of cards falls. But that can take years.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the hard thing for the public with respect to science, that individual scientific studies on their own are not definitive. But when you have to make a decision, relying upon a body of evidence might be the most reasonable thing to do, even if it might prove wrong in the end.
Heather Douglas is my guest. She's Wolf Chair of Science and Society at the University of Waterloo and author of the 2009 book Science, Policy, and the Value-Free Ideal. She's in town to lecture at the invitation of the UT Dallas Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. If you'd like to join our conversation, call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll talk more with Heather and more with you about this in a couple of minutes. Right now, I am joined once again by Jeff Whittington, who is senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. We have a new goal, a new fundraising goal for this hour, Jeff.
Yes, Chris. Our goal for the second hour of Think today is $2,750. So you can help us get started on that. We have just just about 42 minutes to get there. $2,750. Call 888-694-6931, 1-888-694-6931 is the toll-free number, or click and join online at kera.org. We mentioned earlier some of the different special gift packs that we have.
We need a science gift pack.
We do need a science. Well, we have the smart pack, you know, with the two radio bookmarks and the
there's some science involved in this.
There's some computer science in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can check those out online at kera.org. And for your $10 a month contribution or $120 all at once, we will whisk them your way.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number to become a member or renew a membership or revive a membership if you've let it slide. You can also go online to kera.org. Your support makes it possible to have conversations like this. I feel very confident in saying, Jeff, although I did not run around and do research, but I feel very confident in saying there is nowhere else on the broadcast dial in North Texas where you would get a one-hour discussion on science, policy, and the value-free ideal anywhere. If this is the kind of conversation that you love, that it sparks your thinking, it makes you wonder about things you hadn't considered before, allows you to come to conclusions on your own, please support this kind of radio with your dollars, because it would be hard to have this conversation on a commercial radio station. They do some great work, but they are limited in terms of content because advertisers want to deliver a certain sort of audience. We're just here to serve you, and your money makes it possible.
You do make it possible, and I would go ahead and mention also that this isn't the first time that we've covered this kind of topic or talked about these issues on this show. This is a regular stop for us in our trip along the waterfront because you know we want to make sure that we bring you conversations that you find interesting. You know, people are calling in right now, getting on the phone, ready to ask a question and participate. That's what this is all about. That's what Think is all about. That's what public radio is all about. And we're thrilled to bring it to you. Of course, it has a cost, and that's why we fundraise on the air and ask you to help offset that cost.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number, or you can go to kera.org. It's a wonderful thing to be able to work on a show where we don't have a point of view to deliver to you. We're not trying to convince you of anything. We're just trying to talk to the world's most intelligent, best reasoned people about how they have reached their conclusions and then allow you to reach your own. If you value this, please go online now. Let us know at kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Heather Douglas.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Wolf Chair of Science and Society at the University of Waterloo, Heather Douglas. She's in town to lecture at the invitation of the UT Dallas Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. That event starts at 7:30 tonight, and it is titled Science versus Politics, the Battle for Integrity. Join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Heather, you propose this new ideal by which we accept the role of values in science but protect the integrity of science. What does that mean?
So, the way I've been thinking about it is that there are crucial moments in the scientific process where if you allow values to play any role whatsoever in the doing of science and scientific reasoning, you'll actually undermine the reason we do science. So I think if you think about
By introducing a bias to something?
By introducing a bias, by allowing the value to shape or determine or direct the choice. Mm-hmm. So if, for example, you're doing a study and the evidence is coming out one way, but you as a scientist want the evidence to come out some way, a different way, that's not a good reason to change what you write down in your lab notebook.
Sure.
So it's exactly that kind of role for values that I'm saying shouldn't be allowed, to protect the integrity of the process, to keep science grounded in the evidence, to make it an empirical process. So that's where integrity of science can be protected. Values don't play what I call a direct role. So I make a distinction between a direct role where the values actually determine the choice and an indirect role where the values don't determine a choice but help you figure out whether or not there's enough evidence there to make a particular choice. And so there's a direct and the indirect role is slightly more subtle. The more evidence you have, the clearer evidence you have, the less uncertainty there might be, the less role for a value that there is there. So the indirect role is fine throughout the process. The direct role is not fine when interpreting evidence or characterizing data. That's where the values have to be kept circumscribed to protect this key idea of scientific integrity.
Okay, so we've stipulated that. In science, much like in politics, we all love the idea that this could possibly be pure and that the money is out there. But we know that a lot of science would not get funded were it not funded by people who have specific interests, not necessarily the scientists themselves, but the funders come in. I wonder, is disclosure enough to assume that the science is pure, or is there a step beyond that that we need to take?
Unfortunately, studies of disclosure show that it's not enough. Hmm. So some studies of disclosure practices, and particularly for conflict of interest purposes, suggest that disclosure actually increases scientists' willingness to potentially introduce bias because they think, oh, I've disclosed that I took the money from so-and-so. Hmm. So now I can say exactly what my funders want me to say, as if that somehow makes it okay. Disclosure is not enough. So what would be enough? That's actually a really difficult question. And a lot of people are struggling with that right now. So, for example, it's just not clear that having disclosure of funding sources for, say, pharmaceutical research mm-hmm. is going to be sufficient for gaining confidence in the products of pharmaceutically funded research into drugs. And some philosophers like Jim Brown at University of Toronto there's a gentleman also at London whose name escapes me right now, have been arguing that, in fact, we need alternative funding mechanisms. Mm-hmm. So Jim Brown has argued that we should have totally socialized funding of pharmaceutical research. The alternative is a much more reasonable proposal where the funding might still come from pharmaceutical research, but that it be funneled through a central agency that then distributes the funds to scientists doing the research so that there's no direct link between the money and the science being done.
Of course, the argument could be made there that a pharmaceutical company with a great interest in making money, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, mm-hmm. would be far less inclined to put significant resources behind research that they couldn't directly control.
So the proposal that I can't remember his name.
It's okay. We probably will. I will say I don't know it anyway, so you can just paraphrase. We'll trust you.
This proposal is very interesting. He actually suggests that the FDA say they won't approve, won't use any studies that aren't done through a central agency where the money is then filtered through the agency for the direction of which drug should be funded. And that would give the pharmaceutical companies a real incentive to fund that research because they're not going to get any of their drugs approved if they don't do the studies through this particular agency. Right now, any study that's published in the peer review literature that meets FDA standards for methodology gets done. And there are a lot of worries about how those studies are actually done on the ground.
How much time do scientists spend worrying about unconscious bias, something that doesn't necessarily bother politicians but is an issue for science?
I think they actually spend a fair amount of time worrying about it. They worry about it in terms of whether or not they feel like they like their own theory too much.
Mm-hmm.
There's also worries that are increasingly being voiced both by philosophers of science and scientists about whether or not you have sufficient epistemic diversity within a scientific field so that you have competing alternative explanations being raised and investigated in a serious way, because if everyone investigates only sort of one set of explanations, then those are the ones that gain support, and you might not realize that there's a perfectly good alternative explanation just sitting there waiting to be tapped. Feminist scholars of science particularly pointed this out, in particular in certain fields in the 1980s and 1990s, that there were really obvious alternative explanations for, say, how humans developed language or how humans developed tools that involved women instead of men that were just waiting to be explored and put out there. And once they are both on the table, people could really start looking at what the evidence supported for a broader range of alternative explanations.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Heather Douglas is my guest. Her 2009 book is called Science, Policy, and the Value-Free Ideal. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go first on the phones to Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Yes. Hello, Chris. Great show again.
Thank you.
What I wanted to ask the guest today was how familiar she is with Carl Sagan's baloney detection kit and how that is relevant to the goals that she might be aspiring to make the public more aware on becoming scientifically literate and make good decisions based upon the confusing data that comes out constantly. So thank you very much for taking my call, and I'll listen to the answer.
Thank you.
So I grew up watching Carl Sagan on Cosmos. But it's been far too long since I looked up his baloney detection kit, so I don't remember the details.
Well, let's see. Do we still, Mike? Are you still there? Can you tell us how the kit worked?
Well, you know, it's basically about having transparent data and certainly not taking the first study as the final solution to any kind of a problem. The best way to discover more about that for yourself would just be go to the Skeptic Magazine website, and that's Michael Shermer's organization, and was co-founded with Carl Sagan and his wife, Andrian. So go to skeptic.com. That's the best way to do it, and refresh your memory.
All right. Thanks for your call.
So The Skeptic is a very useful website for you know, looking at these sort of things and getting a good perspective on them. The problem with things like transparent data is, could you imagine, people put all the data, say, for the climate data for the entire planet out there and say, okay, now you, the public, interpret it. It's literally thousands and thousands of data points. And even, I've been following the climate change debate for 20 years. I wouldn't know how to begin interpreting the raw data. So there's always an act of interpretation that's needed. And what I would like to have is actually scientists being much clearer about how they go about interpreting the data, being clear with the public about the assumptions that go into that. That's not going to necessarily help the citizens detect baloney, but it'll certainly help the citizens assess which science is more reliable at the end of the day.
There's also the reality, and we have seen this numerous times throughout history, when accepted science that everyone sort of in the academy has accepted as established truth turns out to be false. I mean, I think about, the fact that the sun does not revolve around the earth. That sounded crazy hundreds of years ago.
That's exactly correct. So the interesting thing is that on the one hand, you think, oh, wow, science has been wrong in the past. Why should we believe it? But the fact that science is so self-critical, the fact that science can overturn such deeply held and apparently obvious beliefs like surely the sun rises and moves around the earth, or surely light should be a particle or a wave, not both at the same time, or surely we didn't evolve from other organisms. Those sort of things that might have seemed obvious at one time, that scientists were able to gather evidence and critically examine and overturn our previously held beliefs, is why science is so robust epistemically. It's why it's our most reliable source of knowledge, is the very fact that science can prove itself wrong over and over again.
And strives to do that in many cases.
Exactly.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Karen on the line in Oak Cliff. Hey, Karen.
Yes. One of my concerns is the media and their use of non-good sources. Actually, a bad example from Earth and Sky, of all things, during the oil spill, they interviewed a marine biologist, reasonable about the oil spill,
mm-hmm.
but they asked her about drilling the relief wells and what their purpose was.
Hmm. Yeah, that's sort of what Heather was talking about earlier. How do we, Karen, I mean, I'm sure scientists would love to be able to fix the media, as would almost everybody else on the planet. Any thoughts?
So I think one of the things that's happening as science journalists grapple with this is the old idea of science journalism objectivity was you tell two sides.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would often strive to find the expert who would disagree. And I think the media is beginning to realize that this is a ridiculous view of objectivity, that in fact telling two sides may not be the right thing to do at all, that equal time for both sides might not actually give you the most objective view. And so as science journalists struggle with what should count as an objective account of a particular issue, I think that they're going to begin to let go of this old ideal because it doesn't work and develop something more sophisticated where they might be checking to see who might have good arguments,
mm-hmm.
And who has good reasons to disagree, and asking scientists, perhaps even within their own piece, to critique the other view so they can see, is this even worth reporting or is it so obviously incorrect, it's not even worth talking about.
Heather Douglas is my guest. She's Wolf Chair of Science and Society at the University of Waterloo. She's in town to lecture at the invitation of the UT Dallas Center for Values in Science, in Medicine, Science, and Technology. That event happens at 7:30 this evening in the Johnson Performance Hall on the UTD campus. It is free and open to the public. If you would like to join our conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Joined once again by Jeff Whittington, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know and senior producer of Think. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. I want to thank Crystal Blow and Brandon Lewis in Bedford, Aaron Smith in Corinth, and Hengema Afshar in Little Elm. Also, we heard from Ronald Jordan in Roanoke, Sharon Farris in Irving, and James York in North Richland Hills here in the last few minutes. Thanks so much to each of you for calling 888-694-6931 or for contributing at kera.org. Our goal for the second hour, I think today, $2,750, just $2,220. Oh, we're getting an update now. Actually, just $1,980 left to raise this hour. I think we fell just a little short last hour, so we want to really push past this one. And if you've been waiting for a conversation that is interesting to you that you may not hear, or I can pretty much say you won't hear on any other show here probably in the North Texas area, well, what's that worth to you? Pick up that phone or go online to kera.org and please make a contribution.
Your dollars go to work for you every single day of the year. 1-888-694-6931 is the number. You can also go to kera.org. You know, we're talking so much about science in this hour, Jeff. This is sort of a cause and effect thing. We are experimenting with this 12-day fundraising campaign. We are hoping that you prove us right, that you want a shorter fundraising drive. We have a certain amount of money to raise that we have to raise. If somehow it doesn't work out this time, then the next drive will be that much longer so that we have the money that's required to keep the station strong and to serve you in the way we need to. So please prove our hypothesis correct.
I know what you're saying, Chris. you're saying we've gotten all scientific with it.
And make a contribution. Provide some evidence that you prefer the short drive to the long drive.
Right. We took 24, and live on the air, we divided it in half.
That is right.
And lo, there were 12 days.
Right now, we have only anecdotal evidence that you want a shorter drive
right.
from the multiple calls and emails that you provide us telling us this. And we're testing this theory now
yeah.
with your contributions.
Yeah, we have heard from many, many of you over the years, hey, the shorter drive would be great. And we did have that whopper of a drive last January. The 24-day drive, the Egyptian Revolution was shorter than the membership campaign that we had last winter. And, you know, we were focused on reaching that goal. And we needed to reach the goal. The goals are mandatory. They're not arbitrary. It's what the station needs to raise to get the job done, to continue to bring you the services that you need. But, you know, a 24-day drive is a pretty big drag on what we can do with our regular jobs, because we still have our regular jobs to do, and so do the reporters and all the other on-air folks and all the folks that you don't hear on the air all the time, but you do during the membership campaign. So, you know, the idea is if we can convince you that, you know, you like a shorter membership campaign, which we know you do. Everybody likes that. We like it too. And then we divide live math on the air, divide the 24 days in half and come up with 12 days. We're going to try to do all the money in half the time. And that's why we're looking for $1,980 still this hour to stay on track to accomplish that goal.
Lots of you listening right now will eventually make a contribution in this drive. We know that. We know that historically. Why wait? Why not do it now? Help us to make this our goal. Help us to reinforce the idea that a short drive is a better drive. The reality is we still save you a lot of time, even in our 24-day mammoth drive, as compared with having commercial advertising on the mm-hmm. air all the time. But look, if we can do this in half the time, we would love to. We know that you prefer programming to fundraising. So do we. So help us out. Make your contribution now and really do yourself a favor by providing yourself another great year of not only fantastic content over the year, but a really phenomenal website with new things being added all the time. You can make your contribution over the phone at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
If you'd like your very own Think mug, you can pick that up with our thanks when you make a contribution of $60 or more. If you make a $120 contribution, which is right around the average gift,
you get a match set.
We can give you two Think mugs because they are available for $60 contribution. And they're, you know, it's the black 14-ounce ceramic mug with the Think logo on it. And as Chris likes to point out, although she never does it to me, but you can hold it up in a meeting and be real obvious with it.
Because you've got your own, so we would just be having the battle of the holding up the Think mugs.
That's right, that's right. I want to thank MG Movasagi in Arlington for making contribution. Jeff Ninsel in Denton, Jeff Knight and Elizabeth Ramsey in Fort Worth. Thank you. Especially thank you, Jeffs. Martha White in Fort Worth, Gregory Loudon in Dallas, and Jerry Dillon in Flower Mound. The station is on the air and operating, and we're bringing you the Think Show because of folks just like the ones whose names I just read. They are helping pay for the service. Won't you please join them?
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can go online to kera.org. If you wonder how we spend your money, you're hearing it right now. This is what your money pays for. It's for the programming and keeping the station updated, keeping the signal strong by taking care of the equipment. Please make a contribution now in support of lifelong learning at your public radio station, 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Heather Douglas. She's Wolf Chair of Science and Society at the University of Waterloo and author of Science, Policy, and the Value-Free Ideal. She'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at UT Dallas with a lecture entitled Science versus Politics, the Battle for Integrity. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. We have John on the line in Denton. Hey, John.
Hi, I'm really enjoying your program.
Thank you.
I'd like your guest to speak to one of the practices of the pharmaceutical industry in using relative risk numbers instead of absolute risk numbers in their presentations of their product lines, particularly to doctors.
Thanks so much for your call. Before you answer the question, Heather, if you could talk about relative versus comparative or absolute risk.
So relative risk measures tend to be measure, sort of comparative measures. You'll ask, what's the risk of this relative to, say, something else? And you have to decide what that measure is. And then absolute risk measures would just be, you know, what is the chance of something happening? Mm-hmm. Just to court. I'm not exactly quite sure what the caller is referring to with respect to pharmaceutical industry practices in this regard. Has been more sort of on the radar screen for concerns over pharmaceutical research is whether or not they're comparing efficacy studies, whether they're comparing against a placebo or against the already existing treatment. And that might be what he's thinking about. I'm not entirely sure. But you can imagine if you have to just show efficacy with respect to already existing treatment, it's going to be a lot harder than showing with respect to a placebo. And so one of the things that this is particularly relates to is the issue of patents and pharmaceutical companies want to be able to maintain intellectual property rights as long as possible in the face of generic drugs. And if they only have to show efficacy with respect to a placebo, they can get a new patent for a new drug that they can put on the market that will give them intellectual property rights for a longer period of time. If they have to show it with respect to existing treatments, that's going to be a harder task. And so they're less likely to get that patent and that new intellectual property right.
So many of the things we've been talking about this hour, ultimately, based on what you're talking about this evening, come down to how well do politicians understand what the science is and how to move forward. Talk about what you see as the ability of the two sides to communicate with one another and what we might do to improve that.
So certainly we are no longer in the days where scientists speak and then politicians just believe them.
Whatever you say.
Whatever you say. And it's not entirely clear to me that we ever were in that period for very long. There mm-hmm. might have been a period from Sputnik in 57 to the end of the Kennedy administration where science advisors were just believed. But even that, there were still from some fraught decisions. Before that and after that, there was always some worry about whether or not the scientists should actually be believed. What I think both scientists and politicians need to keep in mind is what it is that they're trying to gain by bringing scientific expertise in and what sort of reasonable expectations there are of scientists. So scientists aren't going to give you an absolute truth. They also are probably not going to be able to solve complex social problems in a simple way. Politicians also shouldn't use science as cover for difficult political decisions. I mean, sometimes the decisions are really tricky political social issues, and just saying, oh, the science tells me to do this, might be just cover for what should really be a more robust debate in our policy realm about what we want to do as a society.
So the science is only one factor in those decisions, or should be.
It should be. Mm-hmm. And that should be recognized by both the scientist and the politician. So it's just not the case that science can dictate to us what we need to do. It only seems that way if the values are so glaringly obvious. Like, we don't want to have massive death. So if science tells us that, say, an asteroid is streaking towards the Earth and it will cause massive death when it strikes, well, then it's really obvious we need to do something about it, like go deflect the asteroid.
Again, the consequences of being wrong are bigger on one side than the other.
Exactly. And it's also really clear that we all agree on the values. A really big asteroid strike would be bad for everybody. Mm-hmm. But most cases are much more complicated than that. There are winners, there are losers, and the values are often contested. Legitimately so in the society. And in that case, the scientist is not going to be able to dictate a particular course of action. And for politicians to ask scientists to provide them that political cover is really unfair. Mm-hmm. The politicians should generate the kind of public debate that needs to happen around those issues.
We have an email here from Paul in Terrell who asks, would it do any good to require scientists to publish their negative results, or would that just be a useless data dump?
That's a great question. There have been attempts to try to get around this problem of really scientists tend to only publish findings that are positive. And this is not just the scientists' fault. It's in many ways the journals that tend to really only want to publish clearly positive findings.
Because it's more exciting, right?
It's much more exciting mm-hmm. to say, hey, we discovered this, and then instead of, well, I did this experiment, but it didn't work.
Right. I was wrong.
Yeah. But the truth is, for both scientists and for the public, the publication of, well, we tried this and it didn't work could be really useful. It could keep a scientist from going down a really unproductive path that they might, from a different lab. The idea of having study registries for really controversial areas like pharmaceutical research, where you say up front, we are planning to do this study, so that you know that there have been studies done and the research may not have been published, but you know that there are results out there that should be looked at, can be really important for policymaking.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Mike in Arlington. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Chris. I'm sorry, but I believe that Heather's proposal for the socialized funding of biomedical research is absurd and ridiculous.
Well, I'll let her respond, but it's not her proposal. She was quoting someone else's idea, but let's get a response.
Yeah, so first of all, it's not my proposal. I was just speaking to what some other philosophers of science and commentators on this issue have proposed to suggest there's a lot of flux in this area. I'm honestly not exactly sure how we should fix pharmaceutical funding of research. We do know that the vast majority of studies that are funded by the pharmaceutical industry find positive results, and it's unclear whether that's just the result of really good luck of the pharmaceutical industries or whether there's a genuine problem of bias in the construction of the studies, perhaps a cherry picking of data that happens that's quite hidden in the process where you only pick the positive population results out of a broader set of studies.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Ken on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Ken.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thank you.
Yes. My question is, how is science supposed to get the truth out when large vested interests like big oil buy professors from different universities or scientists to say just the opposite?
What do you think, Heather?
So this is a very serious issue that philosophers have been starting to think about in terms of the commodification of academic research and the way in which money might be not necessarily directing the results of studies. You would certainly hope that a scientist wouldn't just get the result that they were paid for, that they would actually have enough integrity to maybe do a study and report the results that are actually found, but that it also might alter the direction of scientific research. This has been found in areas of agricultural research where if you look at the direction of agricultural research, a lot of it is focused around the use of pesticides and artificial fertilizers as areas of investigation rather than alternatives that are not, say, so patentable. Mm-hmm. And so there's a concern that what we are even studying, what we are attempting to know, what we come to know, is really overly directed by certain interests. How to solve that? One solution is, of course, to keep up the levels of the public funding of science. So there are alternative voices. Sheldon Krimsky wrote a book a few years ago called Public Interest Science, where he said, look, we have to make sure that science isn't just a private interest funding thing. For scientists who take money from private interests, one of the things I've seen is, you can take money once. It's not a problem to take money once from a private interest. The problem happens when, if you're going to keep going back to the same well, then you tend to want to produce the results that the funder wants. So we might sort of ask scientists to try to avoid that sort of practice, if they're going to take money from private interest, to either get a huge lump sum up front so that there's no further strings down the line, or that they get it from a diversity of sources rather than one source where they're going to be trying to get the certain results that are wanted by that funder.
Heather Douglas is Wolf Chair of Science and Society at the University of Waterloo and author of Science, Policy, and the Value-Free Ideal. Her lecture tonight at the UT Dallas Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology is titled Science versus Politics, the Battle for Integrity. Starts at 7:30 and it's free and open to the public. Heather, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you listening this hour. Thanks to everyone who has called in and written in. And especially we want to thank those of you who have made financial contributions to the station. Your money makes it possible for us to do this work here, for us to bring you conversations like the one we just had with Heather Douglas and the conversations we have on a variety of different topics. If there's one thing you can say for certain about, I think, the lineup of ideas and guests and subjects on Think is that you really never know what you're going to get from one day to the next. I mean, you can check the rundown.
I know.
But Jeff knows. But you know what I mean. I mean, there is no there's no one thing we cover or don't cover.
I'm just playing.
Except we don't cover a lot of sports, but even that we have covered.
We have covered sports. We have, you know, that's really what's so much fun about bringing the show to you is that you know, we hear from you, and you, many of you give us suggestions on topics and guests that we should cover, and of course we keep up on what's going on around the world and what the hot topics are, and when we can get those folks in here in person, we do. And when we can get them on the phone, we do. And you know, we are able to bring you these conversations right here to you in North Texas because you make it possible. When you support this show and this station, you make this programming possible.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make your contribution online at kera.org. We started the hour with a goal of $2,750 to raise. We still have we've raised just over $1,000. We have $1,715 left to raise. Your contribution right now will bring us closer to the target. I would really love to be able to get it. It is not unheard of for us to raise $1,700. A Friends level member right now could sort of save the hour for us. If you have considered joining the station, supporting the station at or above $1,500 a year, this would be an ideal time to take action on that. You can do it online at kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. We have lots of thank you gifts that you can check out online if you are interested, including those Think Mugs at or above the $60 level. We have books from earlier in the week. Whatever might sweeten the deal and make you take action, we say go for it.
Two really interesting books from earlier in the week, Chris. We had Luis Alberto Urrea on, and his book, Queen of America, mm-hmm. has been really popular. And you were saying it's getting a lot of book club action.
Absolutely.
Out there.
Yeah.
So that's one that's available when you join the station at the $120 level. Yesterday, we also had Henry Alford, who writes for Vanity Fair, and he's appeared on NPR a number of times. And his book about the decline of manners in the world today. The show is great. And I would encourage you, if you missed it, to go and listen to it on the Think page. Just click on the show page for Henry Alford. You can click and play. But his book is available. It's called Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. And it's also available at the $120 membership level. Of course, you also get the radio show and you get the station for a full year when you support it. Just $1,590 left to raise this hour to make the goal, to stay on track, to finish this drive in half the time it took last year. That's our overall goal, the overall goal of making it. So help us stay on track. If you've been considering supporting the station, why not do it right now?
How about a Friends level member and a $90 member? $90 is $7.50 a month on the sustaining membership plan. I still sometimes want to call it the Easy Checks plan, which we haven't called it in years.
Yeah, but it used to be.
It's this monthly draw from your account into the KERA membership account. And once you set it up, it keeps going. If for whatever reason you need to change it, sometimes people actually increase their contribution. Sometimes they need to switch them. We don't make it complicated and impossible like some other things you subscribe to.
And I think you now have to put a dollar in the jar in the membership department because you
We're
said
saying Easy Checks plan.
That's $2.
That's my contribution to the station.
It's a sustaining membership these days, and it's really easy to do because you can put it on your credit card, you can put it on your debit card, you can put it on your checking account. We make it as easy as possible. Listen, it's not about making it hard for you to give money to the station. It's about making it easy and convenient, and we want to be able to accept your dollars, your generous dollars, any way that you want to send them to us. And if it's a bag of nickels, it's a bag of nickels. But, you know, that's not convenient necessarily for you either. It might just be fun. So, you know, come down to the station and, you know, you can drop off a check if that's what you'd like to do. But the easiest way really is just to grab that phone right now and call 888-694-6931. A very friendly person will walk you through the membership process. Or if you want to fill out the membership form yourself, do it on the Safe and Secure website. Just click on the support link at kera.org.
You know, Jeff, something you said last hour has really stuck with me, and that was running into someone who said, well, why should I pay for that? It's free. I mean, you have to ask yourself at some point, why does any of us do anything we are not absolutely compelled to do? Why do we, you know, take care of people? Why do we celebrate friends' birthdays? Why do we volunteer at church or at our kids' schools or in the community? Why do we do anything? Because we want the world to be a certain way. You listen to public radio, clearly you want the world to have public radio. You want specifically this community to have public radio. If you want it to be this way, you have to take action and do something about it. about it. Now, the amount of action you take has only to do with your choices and your budget. You can decide how much to contribute to the station. But we would ask that if you want there to be public radio, you take action to support public radio.
Yeah, and in all honesty, that person, that friend of mine, she was just trying to wind me up, really.
It worked. That's what she was wound up to.
That's what she was doing. But she has a point. I mean, that's you know, possibly an attitude of someone who listens to the station. Maybe not somebody who listens all the time, but we know that you have to listen for a few years before you start to become one with the mission and understand the funding model and kind of realize how important your role is. And if you're there, then today, let's make today the day. If you're not there yet, well, we really can't call you out by name and we can't come visit you or knock on your door, and nor would we. But hopefully you'll get there someday. And I believe that if you're going to get there someday, why not make it today? Why not call the number 888-694-6931? Why not click over to KERA.org and make your contribution there? Why not do it today?
Justin Martin actually would come visit you if he could find you, but he'd be extra friendly and polite and still encourage you to make a contribution to the station. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can go online at kera.org. The last update we have is that we need to raise an additional $1,590. If you can initiate your transaction now, help us out with any portion of that. We would greatly appreciate it. Your support keeps KERA strong and vibrant. It allows us to bring you the programming that you love to listen to every single day of the year. We are now at $1,555 left. Please make a contribution now online at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931.